Right on the button, guys.
Right last here,
guys.
Stone for Kevin Martin. They want it on the button. The fans are on their feet. Kevin Martin goes out as a champion.
Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Inside Curling. I'm Jungle Jim Jerome, your host of the show, and of course we do it every week with the one and only Kevin Martin, greatest curler in the world, and the one and only Warren Hansen, okay, the greatest builder of the game. And it's a good thing we have Warren on here, Kevin, because a lot of people have been taking him on now. This is our 40th show, okay, and and you and I get to look at all this stuff. Would we call Warren outspoken?
Fired up?
This just in. Yeah, this just in. Warren, how are you? I'm picking on you.
I'm fine, Jim.
Good. You know, I tell everyone, Kevin, every time Warren says hi to me, I feel like I'm in trouble. You know, I say, hey, Warren, how are you? He goes, hi, Jim. Okay. I used to get that every afternoon in the Briar Patch. Warren was so busy. And then I was going bananas in the Briar Patch and I'd see him the next afternoon. I'd say, hey, Warren, how are you? Fine, Jim. Can we talk for a second about what happened last night with all the emails I'm getting from people? How are you doing, Kevin?
Really well, Jimmy. You're right. And Warren's got some action fired up around the world, which is fantastic in our wonderful sport.
Yeah, one day we're gonna read the emails. There's some people, Warren, who don't like you. You know, are you ever nervous about that, Warren? You're right that you respond to all these people in the emails. We have topics that are controversial, and you keep plowing through. It's like, are you sure you want to, you know, take these people on, Warren? Some of these.
It's opinions. We'll never move things forward if we don't hear what people are thinking and what their opinions are. And I mean, and you have discussion. I mean, that's how we advance things. Everybody operating silent in a silo, nothing's going to happen positively.
Well, I guess that answers the question, Kev, right there. On today's show, we've got a number of things we're going to talk about, including a guest that we'll introduce in a second. They have announced the 18-team format for the Briar. And the Scotties, Warren, are they doing it both, 18 teams for each?
Yes.
We're going to talk about that, even though, as we record this, provincial playdowns are kind of happening, but kind of not. So how we're going to get to those 18 teams, we don't know. The growth of curling in the U.S. versus Canada. We got an interesting email from Brad from Curl Vegas about that. Some stuff about the hog line rule. In the old days, you never used to be able to slide past the hog line, right? And now, of course, you can go right down to the other end, Kev. Were you a good slider, Kev? Could you go all the way down?
We could go all the way down, Jimmy. Yeah. And that is an interesting discussion that we should have probably brought up a few episodes ago even.
Yep. We're going to do that. Everyone's heard of the Purple Heart. You know, that how do you get a Purple Heart? A lot of us think you have to get into the Briar to get it. I think it's getting kind of confusing. Warren's got some history on that and a poll question about that. And instruction. We got an email from Joe Hollis talking about instruction at curling clubs and what he'd like to see happen. And of course, a guest. You know, our guests have pretty lofty stats, Kevin. Okay. All the guests we've had on the show, they're all Canadian champs. Many are world champs. And we do a lot of talk about, we have over the last 40 shows about the growth of curling in Canada. And I think Warren has something to say about that and where it's at. And so we got to look after the juniors. And we've got a 3-time Canadian junior champ and world junior champion. Tyler Tardy is with us from BC. How are you doing, Tyler?
Good. How are you guys? Big fan of the show.
Attaboy, Tyler. Attaboy. Great. Okay, now, yeah, we're going to. That's all we need to do. Thanks, Tyler. You can go now. That's all we need you to say. Tell us, Tyler, give us a little bit about you. What's going on? Your stats are terrific. You're 22 years old now, but you started winning junior stuff in 2016. Was that the first time you went in and you won 3 years in a row after that, 2017, 18, and 19. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I had a pretty good stretch there, and now I'm just a has-been junior curler trying to make something out of a career. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I'm surprised you're not turning gray at the old age of 22 now, Tyler. Okay. Yeah. You're doing that. Do you got a team still together? Tell us about that. What's happening? Where are you curling?
Yeah, we're curling at Langley. We got Jason Ginter out of Alberta, my brother Jordan Tardy, and Sterling Middleton, who I've curled for pretty much just as long as my brother. So
I see your dad's on that as a coach on that team too, Tyler. When did it all start for you, curling? How old were you when you started throwing rocks?
I actually started curling when I was 8. And I actually had to take a year off because no one really knows this, but my brother didn't actually like curling. And we had to stop because we couldn't really get away there because we both had to be there. And then I begged my parents to go back, and then we both got hooked ever since he changed his mind on the sport.
So at 8 or 9 years old, when you started at 8 years old, did you, like most Canadians, were you playing hockey back then first?
I was, yeah. I was a big-time goaltender, actually. One goalie of the year. That's my mini claim to fame in hockey. But, yeah, I didn't go too far in that one. Loved curling too much.
Who convinced you to get into curling?
I was watching my dad, so I just really liked it from watching it. No convincing needed. It was a hit ever since I started.
Attaboy. And you also won the Youth Olympics, right?
Yeah, with Mary Faye Sterling and Carly Burgess and Coach Helen Radford. That was pretty cool. I played third for my first time in my career, and that was actually fun to say the least. It was nice to have a breath of some fresh air and try something new. And yeah, I loved playing third in that event. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So you've moved out of the curling, the junior age now, and yet I was, you know, talking to Warren last night, and we're excited to have you on. You've become more and more passionate that we want to talk to you about through the show about junior curling. And what's your take on that, Tyler, in a nutshell here about where it's going and where you'd like to see it go?
Yeah, I mean, with our personal experience, I think it's hard for juniors to figure out what path to go to get to an elite ranks in the juniors. And it's pretty much who can figure it out the best. And I think the more teams that we can get elite in juniors at an early age, the more great teams we're going to have in the very near future.
Well, good for you. And so we'll talk about more of that through the show. And what are you going to do? You've been on the world curling tour, and you've won a couple times on there, right?
Yeah, we've had a couple good goes at it, hoping to do some more damage in the future.
Attaboy. There we go. Laying down some smack,
Kevin. Yeah. There you go.
I like that.
Yeah, attaboy. Well, thanks for joining us, Tyler. You're going to be a guest host through the rest of the show, and we'll get your comments on a bunch of stuff. This show's no different than any other one. We got a litany of topics that people want to talk about, and we got to pare them down. Otherwise, these shows would never end. It would be on a big loop. We'd just keep going. Warren, let's talk about the announcement of the 18-team format that they want to do for the Brier and the Scotties. I guess that was last week they did that. I don't know how they're going to pull it off. But you also asked a poll question about it, Warren. So walk us through that, Warren. What do you think about what they're trying to do here?
Well, interesting announcement last week that the Brier and Scotties this year are going to go from 16 teams to 18 teams. Kind of interesting when I look back, this idea was being discussed a while ago, like we're talking 2013, 2014, and it kind of got sidelined then. But I think there's a real desire for it to go in that direction ongoing. So we're going to see what happens here. But the main thing, again, they're trying to create a one size fits all here. So to accommodate the 14 provinces and territories as well, to make sure that you've got all your highest ranked teams in there. And so by going to 18 teams, you can probably pretty much more or less make that happen. But you, as a result of doing that, you're going to end up some interesting scenarios. And the most interesting one at the moment appears to be Manitoba, whereas the potential for there to be 4 Manitoba teams in the Scotties. For sure, Jones, Einarsson, and Fleury will be there. But when you look at the rankings, you all of a sudden get down to Mackenzie Zacharias. I think she's number 12 or 13. But she may get in because if you take a look in front of her are a bunch of teams not a bunch, but a few that are going to get in. But there's two or three teams that aren't eligible to be considered this year because they changed two or more players. So you could end up with four teams from Manitoba. Kevin and I have talked earlier. There's a possibility going forward. It'd be easy for Alberta to have three teams on the men's side. So it's kind of interesting. We have this so-called interprovincial play down, yet we're creating situations where you could have four teams cut out of one province. I mean, my point still again is it just is not working anymore the way it needs to be. And it really needs to have a hard look at it, but we'll see how it all unfolds. In the meantime, we also know a number of teams that are going to be going to both the Brier and Scotties at this time. I think eight provinces and territories are pretty much declared. In BC, Corin Brown and Steve Laycock will be the two teams. In Alberta, Brendan Butcher and Laura Walker are going to be their two teams. Saskatchewan, Sherry Anderson and Matt Dunstan. Interesting in case of Saskatchewan, and this has happened a couple of other times, Sherry Anderson actually finished second in the provincials last year. But because the team that won cannot field the same team again, there's two player changes, they're no longer eligible. So over in Manitoba, it's going to be Jennifer Jones and Jason Gunlinson. In Northern Ontario, Kirsta Burns and Brad Jacobs. Again, Burns is going because McCarville refused the offer. Ontario, Rachel Holman and John Epping. Quebec, yet to be determined. Don't know what's going on there. None of it. Laurie Eddy has again been declared the winner on the women's side, but the only playoff I'm aware of that's happened so far has Peter McKay is going to be the men's team of the territories. And of course, Team Canada will be on the women's side, Carrie Anderson, and the men's side, Brad Gushue. So we look at the remaining provinces and territories, Yukon, Northwest Territories, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, PEI, and Newfoundland, Labrador. The only thing that I know of going on, had some communication from Lawrence Forbes in Moncton a couple of days ago saying that things were kind of going along in New Brunswick with some curling taking place. And then I just got a note from last night that said yesterday the New Brunswick women's playdown has been canceled. So we're not sure what's happening in these other provinces' territories. I suspect there may be a few playoffs, but in some cases, I think the teams are just going to be appointed. So interesting, we asked a poll question about the 18-team approach, and here was the question. Now that Curling Canada has increased the field for both the Scotties and Brier to 18 teams, do you think this is a good idea? Please choose one of the following options. First option was, yes, I like the 18 teams. 66% said they do. No, it should revert back to 12 teams in the near future, which this one was interesting. 50% said yes. And no, it should revert back to 16 teams in the future. 27% thought that was the answer. So again, you can see some interesting results. I find the real interesting one is 50% of the people in that poll wanted to go back to 12 teams. And quite frankly, if you're going to run this competition, I'm not sure how that's possible, considering the fact that of those 12 teams, Yukon Northwest Territories, and none of it had one entry. And I'm not sure with this interprovincial competition that would ever be possible again. Anyway, as usual, some interesting stuff. Kev, what do you think of it all?
Well, you know, one thing that you mentioned in the case of the Manitoba Ladies with potential of four teams, Zach Rice is really good. So and of course, the big three. The way I look at a national championship, you know, we want the very best team to win. I like the fact it could be four Manitoba women's teams in it. Now, of course, that brings you back to why 18 teams and why not 12 or something like that. And yes, if you do have a province like Manitoba women right now that is just absolutely stacked with good teams, why not have four out of that province? Makes sense to me. I just don't see why you have all the other teams. But I guess you're right. That's kind of interesting. And in Alberta, men right now easily could have four teams if you include, of course, Botcher Cooey, but then also Hardy and Sturmey. So you've got kind of a big four there as well. But I see that as being a good thing. So I hope that it does go down all the way to, I think it's number 13 or 14 to get Zacharias in. And I know I was having a nice chat with Kelsey Rock a couple of days ago, and they did the same thing. They switched two players. And so they weren't eligible, or they would have got one of those wild card spots. So anyway, that's kind of the way I see it. I see it being a very big positive to have the top teams in our country in the national championship, but to expand from 16 to 18, 18 to 24, 24 to 32, just to make sure all the best teams are in, I would probably just kind of go the other direction.
It continues to make no sense. And I was looking at the men's side last night, and here's an interesting scenario. So there's 18 teams. So with Gushue out of Newfoundland, he's Team Canada, but nevertheless, that's a spot he's taking. And Jacobs out of Northern Ontario, there's 10 teams in the Breyers side that are up there. They're all very capable of being in the final eight. But so out of those 10 teams, two of them are not going to make the final eight. So the chance of any of those other eight teams from 11 to 18 being able to crack into that structure, when there's 10 of those teams that are already part of the high performance group, it's just highly, highly unlikely. It wasn't too likely before, and this just makes it practically impossible, I think. Again, this is going to be kind of a funny year because teams haven't been playing. So if there was ever a chance for one of those eight teams or eight provinces, territories to get in there, I suppose this would be the year. But under normal circumstances, it's just not going to happen. So again, you have to ask yourself the question, the system has outlived its usefulness. Is there making any sense? And I agree with an interprovincial competition, but it just shouldn't any longer be the thing that determines the Canadian champion, because it's so unbalanced and just doesn't make any sense.
I have a question just to clarify. So you've mentioned this a couple times, you guys, that if a team switches up two players, now they're not eligible to go to the national championship. Did they know that at the time? Like, if we switch two players, we won't be able to go? Because who would ever do that, Kevin? If you're gonna switch up two guys in your team, going, okay, we'll do that, but now we can't go to the national championship. So I'm kind of confused.
Well, if you want to build the best team possible and try to get the Olympic Games, that's what everybody wants to do.
Oh, okay.
Is get to the Olympic Games. So you switch whatever you need to. I switched three one year, or the three got rid of me. Anyway, whichever way it was there, Jimmy, yeah, back in the day. But no, you do what you got to do. And I know for Kelsey Rock, she picked up a terrific front end with Rochelle and Dana. So, and of course, had to split the team in half, and it's going to cost her a visit to her national championship. But did she improve her curling team? I would vote yes. So, you know, if you're going to try to build your team better, and if it does take switching two players, well, so be it. And in most years, Jimmy, you could have entered your provincial with the new team of 2-2 and still went to the national, right? It's just because they're your hand-picking teams this year.
That's what's all happening. That's what's created the situation. The only team that would be impacted by this normally would be Team Canada. And it's the same situation. They can switch one player, they can't switch two. But the reason this is all becoming an issue here, because we're going through this situation here now where we're virtually selecting teams from the past season, which is why if you've changed two players, you can't have that team coming forward. But under normal circumstances, that wouldn't be an issue.
So, Tyler, when you hear all this stuff, what do you think of the 18-team deal? I mean, you want to get to the Breyer as bad as anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple ways to look at it. You know, I really like the mixed doubles format, and they kind of do that kind of a thing. They have a bunch of CTRS and the doubles curling tour points teams, and then they also have the provincial representation. So they have a bunch of the provinces, and they also have top doubles teams, and that works really well. Mm-hmm. And then going with the Breyer, I think the longer curling succeeds in Canada, the more elite teams we're going to have. So a lot of those teams might be on the sidelines in the future if we keep the same format. So like when I end up retiring curling, there might be 20 plus elite teams in Canada on either the men's or women's side. And a lot of those teams might end up not being able to curl in the national championship because there are too many elite teams. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like if for whatever reason, a bunch of the elite teams went to Manitoba and say there's nine teams out of Manitoba that are elite, you're not really going to just have one of those eight or nine teams at the national championship. So you're in a little bit of a tough spot, but I think growing the field is kind of the right direction to go.
So do you think there should be a participant from every province at the Breyer?
I can't really give a firm answer on that because I've never even been a live spectator at the Breyer. So I don't really have a full opinion in that. I don't know what that experience is like. So I don't know how much that provincial representation is a key aspect of the Breyer. So maybe ask me again after I've been to a rare.
Okay. What about
that's an awesome answer.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I will. We'll have to make. I'm making a note here. Okay, let's get back to Tyler here when he wins the Briar. Okay. You know, the Masters golf tournament, we often talk about golf, comparing it to curling. They allow amateurs in. You know, there's four or five of them that are allowed into the Masters, which is not just a pro golf tournament. It is the pinnacle of events. And I really like that. Do you think it's time, because junior curlers are so good, do you think it's time that they allow the national junior champ into the Briar?
I mean, it's a thought. There's been some success of that with some spiels in Ontario. I believe they've been doing that at, they have a Oakville or Stu Sells, where the winner of the junior Tankard goes to the WCT event. And that's been a decent success. I believe there's been a couple teams in the juniors that have actually gone pretty far in that event. So yeah, it'd be a decent mix up.
Boy, that I really like that question, Jimmy. I like your answer, Tyler. To have an event what you're talking about here is changing things. And I like that a lot because, you know, changing means growth, usually evolution. So you have the idea of bringing the junior champ into the Briar, say, or into the Scotties. I think that's terrific. And what you need to do then, if you're going to go that direction, which I totally think is smart, you're really changing it from a pro-amateur idea away from regional idea, actually going down golf's path. Mm-hmm. That's when we start talking about bringing in amateur teams, say from the national, the regional amateur event, bringing in the top couple. Great into the Briar or Scotty mix. Wonderful idea. But in order to bring in the top junior teams, you've got to make that decision where now this is a pro amateur event, not a regional event. And that's where I think the line's got to be drawn going into the future. Right now, I think Curling Canada is kind of walking the path of, well, we don't really have the nerve to switch it. So let's just kind of involve both. Like right in the kind of wishy-washy gray world. No problem. It's all good. Maybe it's just a transition period, which is wonderful. And you're right. You're going to get a lot. Three more of the top teams into this event. Great. But you still got extreme amateurs. So it's kind of in the middle somewhere. And I guess down the road in a few years, Curling Canada is going to have to decide, okay, is this a pro amateur type situation where, like the Masters, you're going to bring some amateur teams in with all the top pros to get their, you know, let them sharpen their teeth. That's a good idea. Or is it just going to remain interprovincial and we're just going to keep adding more teams? Like, you know, to your point, Tyler, if Canada does continue to improve and all of a sudden, you know, three or four of the top teams are left out of this thing. So you go from 18 to 24. Well, if Canada, are you going to keep expanding the field just because of the depth of competition? It doesn't seem reasonable to me.
I think another interesting point that I was having some communication with another person here a few days ago, and I won't mention who it was, but his comment.
Why won't you mention who it was?
His comment was, well, they're going to throw us a carrot again with that pre-trails thing. It doesn't make any sense. He says, what would make more sense? Why don't they have a Curl Canada Cup Tier 2 or even a Canada Cup qualifier? And I thought, you know what? That's a great idea. So, I mean, it would be an annual event. And you now can involve all these teams that are on their way up that aren't quite there. So whether it would be a Curl or Canada Cup Tier 2 event or a play-in qualifier, I think is great. And his point was the pre-trials every 4 years, you know, in all probability aren't going to win or come close to it. So there wasn't a lot of purpose. And I thought he made a very good point.
What's the qualifier now, Warren or Kevin? I'm sure you both know this. How do you get to the Olympic trials?
Well, there's two ways you're going here. You're talking pre-trials and trials. So there's actually trial spots that are played for over the 4 year period, the quadrennial leading into the Olympics. So there's various points given to various things, the Canada Cup, the Briar, the Scotties. And in the end, the pre-trial teams, I believe, Kevin, by my memory, is based on, again, their record over the 4 year period as to how the teams are selected and determined pretty much.
Does that sound right, Kev?
Yeah, it does. It does. The pre-trials is, yeah, you get into there and then the top two, at least it was top two out of the pre-trials, gets into the main trials event. Is that still the way, Warren, or does it move it to one?
I think the last time it was two. But the interesting thing about this whole thing is, I mean, the way huge emphasis is placed on Olympic success by the funding agencies, Own Podium, Sport Canada, and Canadian Olympic Committee. And over a quadrennial, most of that funding goes towards approximately six teams usually. And all of a sudden, you've opened that up to, in the case, I think it was the last trials, it's over 20 teams have a shot. And in all probability, you'd not want those teams that are way down the line to be able to come through that and win. And the probability of that is not very good, but strange things can happen. And I'm not sure. I mean, I can remember when this whole thing came about. It was in 2010 because the Olympics were in Canada and felt that everybody needed to be given the at least vision of having an opportunity. And I thought it was going to be a one-off, but it never mind was a one-off. It's continued and has been expanded. And I'm not sure it's the best approach in life. And I think the idea about the Canada Cup with a play-in event or a tier two event would make a lot more sense.
I always thought, to make the world junior hockey team, for example, I mean, you got to make the team. You got to be selected. I always thought, maybe I wonder if there'll ever be a day where Curling Canada or whoever decides how they're going to get to an Olympic entry, that they make up their own team. Kev, we're going to take Kevin Martin as the skip. We're going to take this guy as the lead. Could that ever work? I don't know. Maybe I'm out of my mind.
Nope. Yeah, you are. And the only reason you are out of your mind is the problem that you see in regional territories like Canada. If you took the skip in women's or men's, doesn't matter who, and that person is from the West, then the third has to be from the East because, of course, you got to be Fairsies.
Right.
And then somebody would have to come from somewhere else. And so you really then would be picking territories, not ability. And it becomes very political. And then it is just absolutely will not work. Who's this unbiased person that's going to pick the team?
Right.
Well, it doesn't exist in the world. So no, that's an absolute no, won't work. Hockey has a lot of players, right? You've got a big roster. Mm-hmm. Curling's a very small roster. And, the regional idea would certainly be a problem.
Well, tick that box, Warren. Another tick were dumb questions from Jim.
Okay, next, Jim.
Hey, Tyler, how are you guys able to travel? Do you get funding? Do you have sponsors? What's happened up to now with your team? What's going to happen in the future?
A little bit of both. We've been fortunate enough with some sponsorship and some funding with Curling Canada and their Next Gen program, as well as Curl BC's high performance program. We've just gotten fortunate over the years to be able to travel a little bit more and more and more. Obviously, this year that didn't happen. We were planning on playing a lot. I think we had 12 events on the agenda, and that was unfortunately canceled. But we've just gotten pretty fortunate with how it's all panned out.
What's the Next Gen program from Curl Canada?
It's a group of teams and even some individual players and doubles players that Curl Canada is kind of targeting for like future development. Mm-hmm. So you've got a bunch of past junior champs in it and whatnot. And they're giving us a lot of extra help to kind of help us speed up that process into the men's or women's game.
So does it happen in every province? Do you know? I'm probably throwing you under the bus here a bit.
They have just certain teams and players from multiple provinces. It's not based out of any one province. They've just had training camps in various locations all over Canada over the past, I believe, 2 years ago it started, 2 or 3 years ago.
Very good. And keep those sponsors happy, Tyler. Don't get in trouble like Kevin used to do, and sponsors were dropping them left and right, okay?
Right. Look after those sponsors, Tyler. That's right. Yeah, they mean a lot to you in the long run.
Very good, gentlemen. Speaking of sponsors, boys, we have a new associate sponsor, and we'd like to thank Manscaped. Okay. So for those of you who are fans of the television show Shark Tank, these guys, two of the sharks invested in their company. Manscaped, without question, is the world's best men's below the waist grooming company. Manscaped just recently launched in Canada. So if you're a listener in Canada, this could be your opportunity to experience Manscaped's life-changing product. It's a below-the-waist thing, Tyler. Okay. Go to the Manscaped website at manscaped.com. That's manscaped.com. And if you use the code INSIDECURLING, that's inside curling, you'll receive 20% off and free shipping. Manscaped.com, and use that code inside curling. Okay. The growth of curling seems to be a popular topic all the time. We got a comment from Brad from Curl Vegas. He says, I know, of course, your thoughts on the growth of curling in the U.S., so I thought you might be interested in some numbers that I came up with while researching an article I did recently for USA Curling News Magazine. In the past 5 years, the United States Curling Association has added 38 clubs to their roster, putting their number around 200. 38 clubs over 5 years reveals an interesting stat. There is a new club being formed in the U.S. every 2 months. In 2020, 8 new clubs were accepted into the USCA. Of these 32 are arena clubs. The Arena Avenue has been a significant source of the USA club growth. That's pretty good, Warren.
Yeah, that's excellent. And I emphasize what he's mentioning there about arena clubs. So they've created 38 clubs, 32 of them are arena. So they're curling on arena ice. But I think the more impressive one is the fact that that means there's been 6 new facilities have happened as a result of his comments as well. So I think that's the more important one. But curling in the United States, the arena curling clubs are becoming more and more and more. And matter of fact, they have a arena curling club championship. So I think as growth happens down there on a quick level, that's going to be where a lot of it's going to be happening. And but I think the impressive thing is there's been 6 new facilities built, and things are moving in the United States. And certainly I'm more than familiar with the situation in Las Vegas. And I mean, Kevin and I've got some ideas of where things can go there in the future with curling, but I think it's all going to go upward.
So for those of those, sorry, Kev, for a sec, for those who don't understand the difference between arena and club ice, arena is far inferior, correct, Kevin, than club ice?
Not necessarily inferior. Arena club is a club that shares the ice with, say, hockey or figure skating or something else. And then there's dedicated ice, which is the curling club, mm-hmm. like where it's a curling facility and curling is done there. In the case of, say, Kalamazoo, or a buddy of mine, Garnet Ekstrand, they brought the club together. They opened as an arena club. So they just rented the ice, 2 hours twice a week. You go out and you make the ice as quick as you can and you curl your game, and then hockey comes out when you're done. But it was so successful and so many people got involved with the club. Yeah. They actually took over that building, and now it's a curling facility on arena ice. And I was there, about a year ago, just before COVID. And the ice is fantastic. they do a terrific job. Like it's just gorgeous arena ice. So not the surface is inferior. It's just a different way of looking at it. Like it's something that we don't really do in Canada here, where you have a building and you share with a hockey group. And just have ice times once in a while. So that's kind of the idea. But what I wanted to talk about with this is the, I guess it's like my wife came with me to the Wine Country Curling Club in California to just to help out Lupus Foundation, Regan and Todd Burr and the Lupus.
Oh, it was to drink wine. It wasn't to help out. Come on.
Well, we may have had a glass of wine as well when you're at the Wine Country Curling Club. But, walking into the clubs, we've talked about this a little bit before. It's like walking into a different world. The membership are so excited. They are so into it. And it's all volunteer. And you walk in to the club prior to game time. There's lots of people out there helping. Like they're doing the ice. They're running the rocks. They're getting ready. Because, of course, you don't have much time in a shared ice situation. Mm-hmm. So you've got to get that ice ready. Get the scoreboards up. Get all this stuff. And then you curl your 2 hours. And then it's takedown because, of course, hockey guys are waiting to go. Mm-hmm. So, you just have to resurface and away you go. So it's a different world. It's a terrific world. And that's, I think, one reason it's growing so fast. The last I heard was 212 clubs. So that's about bang on with what Brad thinks. So it's growing really, really quick. And the energy of the people involved in these clubs is out of this world. So I just don't see that growth stopping anytime soon. When you've got that much energy behind a sport, mm-hmm. it's really positive.
Well, listen, there's been a lot of discussion about curling clubs, particularly in Canada, of course, and the high cost of running these clubs. It's become the bane of a lot of the existence of these clubs, where the utilities are really high. The club doesn't get used as much. They're having trouble, getting people there, how they use their bar and all their food and beverage stuff. Why doesn't Canada then, Warren, use more arena and shared ice stuff? We hear this stat here from the States. They got no problem doing it. And their growth of curling clubs is on the rise. Why don't we do more? Are we spoiled? Maybe we're too spoiled here that we only want to use dedicated ice.
There's really not been any need for that to happen in Canada because we've got a lot of facilities. And a matter of fact, we're going the other way. We're losing facilities because of lack of involvement. And I mean, the whole curling facility issue in Canada is a complicated one. And there's a variety of things taking place. In many cases, it's a municipally owned facility, which in my opinion is it should all be. In many cases, it's owned by a group. It's private to some degree, although none of them are private, unless it's a part of a country club operation. And in many cases, the city owns the land that they're on. So there's all kinds of things going on in Canada. We've got lots of facilities. We just have to get things going in the right direction to make sure they're all filled and they're properly utilized. And it goes back to discussions we've had on this show many times. The United States, the curling season doesn't necessarily start in October and end in April in many cases. And I think that's another thing we've got to look at in Canada. These facilities are very expensive to build and to maintain and to keep going. And we only operate them 6 months of the year. And what happens the other 6 months? Well, a variety. Some sit, some rent out their space for banquets, for weddings, all sorts of things of this nature. But the fact remains, if we're even extended that curling season by 3 or 4 months, we would again see more revenue coming in, the whole thing being more probably reasonable. So I think it's another thing in Canada we got to look at. We got to look at extending the season beyond April. Maybe if we started by having it, the season's going to be September till June, and we take off July and August. But again, I always use Shaska, Minnesota as an example. That club's operational 11 months out of 12, and it's busy. And my point being, if that can happen in Shaska, Minnesota, there's no reason why it can't happen in Canada. So I think it just has to be a different approach taken in Canada as to how we utilize the facilities.
I want to ask Tyler something here in regards to your thoughts at your age about curling clubs and ice usage. So we bring this out once in a while, this idea of having more Gen Z type things like mixed doubles, triples, that doesn't take very long. And I get the immediate response when I bring it up. So again, thank you everybody that's going to send me an email tomorrow blasting me or agreeing. But I always hear from the full clubs. Well, our club doesn't have time to worry about mixed doubles. We're full every night. Well, that's not the club I'm talking to here. The ones that have lots of money and are full of curlers, terrific. Good on you. Now, that's not the case all across Canada. And if you're looking at the time schedule, most clubs in Edmonton area, and this is where I want your opinion, Tyler, is generally you might have some practice or something after the kind of like the 4:30, 5 o'clock. First league starts at around 6:15, 6:30. They curl for two hours and 15 minutes, something like that. And then they clean the ice, get it done. Second draw starts at 8:30-ish till 10:30, quarter to 11. Clean the ice, you have a beer and head home. My idea with mixed doubles and triples is it's kind of like tea times. There's a lot of people that don't mind playing a little bit earlier. And if it's mixed doubles, that first league might be able to start at 4:30, something like that. The games only take an hour and 15, hour and 20. Well, you're getting a lot more draws in a night. And I guess I'd love to hear your opinion on mixed doubles at a club level because you can play more draws. The answer I get from people is, we can't do that. That's half the amount of people, half the revenue, but it's almost half the amount of time to play. Your thoughts, Tyler, on involving more disciplines of curling into league play rather than trying to continue the four-person game. And four-person game's great, but it takes longer, and maybe there's a room for mixed doubles and triples in a club. What do you think, Tyler?
Right, yeah. I'm at my home club in Langley. we have a doubles league that started, and that's actually where I'd say majority of our beginner curlers are coming in to try the sport. So I'm usually out there during the late draws, because that's where there's an open sheet or whatnot. And the club manager is asking if I can help give them a quick rundown of what doubles is. It's been great. That's where a good majority of the main beginners play. So I think it's a great way to bring in the sport, because obviously it's quicker pace. It's more exciting, in my opinion, to watch. I haven't actually played triples, and I don't know the format of it, so I can't really speak there. But yeah, I think having more disciplines can definitely be good for the sport and the clubs.
So Kevin,
yeah, triples is just six. Just one sec, Jimmy. So triples is just six rocks per end. So that's why, and it's only six ends. Six rocks, okay. Six ends. So it's very, very quick, and each person takes a turn at the different positions. That's kind of why I like it. Every end, you know, every game you're going to play leads second and skip, whatever way you want to look at the three players. So it kind of gives everybody, especially in a beginning to intermediate level, a chance at playing all the different positions rather than being stuck at lead for 5 years and then kind of going, oh, I'd like to throw a hit someday, and you know, end up quitting. So on these nights when you have mixed doubles and doubles, is it a mixed doubles night, or is it maybe four person curling at such and such a time, and then a mixed doubles league, maybe followed by like another four person league? Because there might be time, Tyler, if you have, say, the 4:30 to 6 slot be mixed doubles, and then time for four person leagues. I don't know. How's it work at Langley?
So we're a six sheet club. So we have the full 6 o'clock draw for regular curling, and then the late draw will only have about two games on the ice, I believe. And then on the other open sheets, we'll have all the doubles games, and there's usually two draws of doubles.
Okay.
So Kevin, I might have a bit of an issue if I'm a mixed doubles curler with what you had said earlier, mm-hmm. that at your club, you're saying that, you know, it's tough to have mixed doubles because it's already filled with so many men's and women's teams. So there's just not enough room to do mixed doubles. If I'm a mixed doubles player, I'm like, why do we have to take a back seat all the time to men's and women's teams? Why can't we get ice time, you know, when we want it, or at peak times or at normal times? Because you said we don't, you know, the mixed doubles, there's just no room. So the men's and women's teams are taking priority over that. And I know leading up to this show, there's been lots of talk about, even from you, Kevin Warren, saying we got to get more mixed doubles going. We got to get triples. We got to get even doubles men's and doubles women. So I'd be a little pissed if I'm a mixed doubles player. They're going, okay, we'll let you know if we can fit you in here. It doesn't seem fair to me.
And doesn't either. But those are the responses I generally get, and will tomorrow again, from the clubs that are full of four-person curling. The problem is, I think the people that say that, they're not looking into the crystal ball and seeing the people like Tyler coming up that don't like 2.5 hour things. They, the generation said, they like about an hour. So if you look into the big picture, you might want to, while your club is full and have lots of money, this might be the time to actually evolve your club before your membership drops in half. And now you're struggling and you're trying to figure out how to make it work. This might be the time to actually make a change. And you don't need to change much. Like a mixed doubles games or triples game fits into a really small slot. Like don't have your four person game go from 6:30 till 8:45 and then to 11 and then stick the mixed doubles on at 11 PM. Like let's make it work in a normal time slot, somewhere 4:30 ish. When the school's done and a lot of people are done work, there's lots of time then. Might even be able to do an afternoon mixed doubles league. But I know a lot of people are stuck on four-person curling, which is wonderful. I four-person curled my whole life. I love mm-hmm. it. But there is other ways to play the game of curling, and they're all fun. And mixed doubles and triples takes a lot less time, and that can be beneficial.
Tyler, your club in Langley, how do they get most of their revenue? And is it in good shape? Is it a struggle for your curling club or not?
They got a couple sources, I believe, with the junior program. That's been a decent hit. And then just leagues. I don't know if they, it's run through the city, so I don't know if they get anything through that. But yeah, ever since I started, I actually started curling there when I was 10. So ever since then, it's been great. I wouldn't say it's gone down by any means. Yeah, the junior program has definitely grown, and yeah, I'd say they're definitely trending upward in Langley.
Very good.
Hey, Jimmy, anytime when you're, that was a great question to ask. Matty Dunstone's, you know, the next Connor McDavid of curling is the guy we're talking to, Tyler, here today. So the Langley Curling Club, when you've got McDavid or Gretzky on your ice, the junior program is probably going to grow. I don't think there's any question about that. The club's going to be looking pretty good when you got the best guy or best lady in your club. I think that's a really good position for Langley Curling Club to be in, and good for them.
Tyler Tardy, the Connor McDavid of curling. I'll take that.
Hey, Tyler, did you know that Matt Dunstone called you the Connor McDavid of curling?
I did hear something about that, but I think he's just blowing some smoke.
That should have been your response. Yeah.
Are you getting so old now, Kevin, that no one is the Kevin Martin of curling anymore? You know,
definitely nobody under the age of 35 or 40.
Anyway, if you like what you're hearing, thanks a lot. We got more stuff we're going to talk about. Our email address is insidecurling@gmail.com, and we're on Twitter at Curling Inside, Facebook at Inside Curling, and of course we're on Instagram at Inside Curling Podcast. Thanks a lot to Rod Paulson, who's doing a bunch of work for us. His company's called In-House Strategies. We appreciate that very much. Send us your emails, and we'll try and get to all of them, but we certainly use them for topics that we want to build for the show. Love to do it. Also, we've had a couple of Zoom meetings with clubs. We've invited clubs from anywhere around the world to set up a Zoom meeting with Kevin and Warren. We've done three or four now, maybe five of those. Kevin, with you, you were in Wisconsin. We did one in Detroit. Was it Amsterdam, Belgium? We did one, Warren?
Belgium.
In Belgium. So we'd love to do that with you if you want. Just email us and we'll set that up. That would be lovely. What's happening, by the way, before I want to get to this discussion about the hogline rule, which you've got some stuff to say, Warren. Any bond spiels going on, Kevin, with all this COVID stuff? Anything anymore?
There have been a couple last week. Yeah, both in Scotland, the women's, the British Curling NCAA January Challenge, and Eve Muirhead. I think we've heard of Eve, and she ended up going undefeated in the round robin, got a bye to the final. Gina Aitken beat Maggie Wilson in the semifinal, and then Muirhead beat Aitken 8-4 in the final. And then at the same event on the men's side in the British Curling, some guy, Bruce Mowat, goes undefeated and has to play the winner of Ross White and Ross Patterson. Ross White won that semifinal game, came in and played Bruce Mowat in the final, but Mowat beat him 8-5. So Muirhead and Mowat ended up winning those events, and not a big shock. Those are two absolutely terrific teams. It was nice to see some curling going on.
Yeah, good. Very good. The rules of curling, fellas, always controversial. We've had most of the discussion we've had about changing the game. I always go to my go-to is what would you like to see change? And I'll ask Tyler that as well, about how many ends, the length of the game, the tick shot, the three rock, four rock, five rock, six rock. Warren, I was talking to him last night. Warren's like, we may have to go to the seven rock rule pretty soon with this talk about the hogline rule. What's all this, Warren, that you're talking about the hogline rule in curling?
Well, the sport of curling doesn't have a lot of rules, but the few it does have, some of them are really important, and probably the most important one is the hogline rule. And it's got an interesting history. Of course, when curling was invented on the ponds in Scotland, you didn't need to worry about people sliding over the hog line because, in fact, they were throwing from a crampet to a target 140-some feet away. But as the game evolved, and of course, the hog line was always there. And the interesting thing as well is, what does the hog line mean? And some people have never understood it. It doesn't have any reference to throwing a pig rock. It actually, the Scottish term is a lost sheep. And one of the definitions I found up, it was a young sheep who hasn't been shorn. But as actually, it's a lost sheep. So what it virtually meant initially was if your stone did not cross, quote, the hog line, it was lost. And that was its purpose. But as the game evolved, we started sliding out of the hack. And as a result, the hog line developed a new purpose. And it was with regard to the release of the stone. Had to happen before you cross that line. But the rule has had varying things applied to it over time. You go back probably in the 50s, 60s when it first came into existence because people started to slide out. And the initial hog line rule with regard to the release of the stone said your sliding foot cannot touch the line before you before the rock has been released. And so that seemed to kind of work for a while, I guess. You could slide up to the line and reach over it to release a stone as long as your sliding foot didn't touch the line where the rock was still in your hand. But some people became very good at being able to actually jump the hog line with their sliding foot. And it got to a point that they did it so well that the rule had to be changed. And this all happened towards the, I believe by my memory, the middle 60s when the hog line rule was changed to be the fact that in a release of the stone, your body had to come to a complete stop before any portion of your body or your equipment touched the line. And that was extremely difficult thing to do. And if you came out of the hack with any power at all, you came to that line, you had to collapse your entire body to stop before you touched the line. Time went on, and in the early 70s, the World Curling Federation, then the ICF, International Curling Federation, decided to change the rule. And in their meeting in 1973, they changed the rule to be virtually what it is today, that the stone had to be completely released from the hand before it touched the line. And they instituted that it was going to be in effect for the 1974 World Championship. However, in Canada, things didn't happen as quickly, and there was some reluctance to go to that rule. So I happened to be fortunate enough to play in the 74 Brier, where all of a sudden, some people from the Canadian Curling Association decided to get some old guys to act as umpires and start pulling rocks at the hog line for people that were touching the line before they actually crossed it or stopped their bodies. And so that resulted in them changing the rule at the annual meeting in 1974 to being what the WCF was, which is what we have today. The rock has to be released. So I had the unique experience of playing in the 74 Brier under the old rule, where you had to come to a complete stop before you reached the line, to then go into World Championship 10 days later where we could slide as far as we wanted. And of course, that rule has stayed in place since then. However, things have changed a lot through time. Sliders have become quicker. The ice surface has become quicker. Deliveries have become better. The ability to come out of the hack consistently, smoothly. And to some degree, it has caused some issues. I always look at the fact of if in golf we didn't regulate the balls and the clubs for the top pros, all the golf courses would have to be 9,000 yards. And I think it's a problem they're facing right now when you see people being able to drive the ball over 330, 340 yards. So in curling, we then decided after things became really good with the deliveries that we are having a problem scoring. Rocks were good, ice was good. And so we brought in a three-rock rule. You know, that didn't kind of do it. We brought in a four-rock rule. Now we've brought in a five-rock rule. And we've talked about the issues with the tick shot. It still is pretty difficult to score. So my question is, well, maybe we have to try the six and seven-rock rules. But if we want to take a look back, we look at this game that was originally designed to throw a rock from a standing position, 146 feet away. We've now taken 30 feet off that. We've come out of the hack at that target going 1,000 miles an hour. And to some degree, have we made it too easy by what we've done? And we can't extend every curling sheet of ice to be another 30 feet longer. So my question has always been, do we need to look at this rule from that point of view? Maybe it needs to go back to where it was in 1974 rather than coming up with a six-rock rule and seven-rock rule.
Right.
I don't know. I think it's a topic of great discussion and possibly experimentation. But Kevin, what do you think of all that?
Can you imagine EJ coming out of the hack at 100 mile an hour? He'd have to have a rubber belly on his suit to be able to stop in time. But you're right. You're right. This is an important discussion to have because it is a problem. You've got, let's just stick with EJ Harney. Let's pick on him. Heck of a good guy. But probably your most accurate there's so many good accurate players, but he's got to rank up there with the very, very best. And, you know, for Brad Jacobs, you have EJ throw a run back as soon as he's allowed, depending with or without hammer, whatever. You know, he seldom misses, and he can scatter. If there's six rocks in play, they're all gone after EJ throws one. You know what happens if EJ happens to miss one, which he may one out of every 10 or 15 tries. Well, Mark Kennedy's next. Well, he's not going to miss. Like, so then, you know, smash, 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 because these guys can throw it so hard. Or if you look at another team, Guju's team or Anna Hasselborg's team, you know, Agnes can throw it 100 mile an hour. And then Sarah. So, like, where's the defense? So this is something we almost need to look at, because the athletes have become so strong and so good. The five rock, six rock, seven rock, eight rock, nine rock, you know, when do the 100 mile an hour heaters start coming down? That's kind of what you're looking at. So this might be something to look at. I don't know exactly how you change it. To have to stop before the line when you have somebody come out at 100 mile an hour would be pretty comical to see how they're going to dig in to be able to stop.
Well, it's doable. From personal experience, it's doable. I mean, in that time, the sliders weren't as quick as they were now. And the ice surface wasn't as fast. But, I mean, I was a guy like Herndon that came out that hard, and I had to absolutely collapse virtually just every part of my body at the hog line to be able to stop and before any part of my body or equipment touched it. So, and it certainly is going to cut down the, I guess, the accuracy or the ability to be that accurate on hitting if, in fact, that's there. So I guess there's something we always got to keep in mind is, when does the game with the rules as they exist not become really a game anymore in the manner in which it was designed? And again, I mentioned golf is the same problem. If the equipment isn't restrained, soon they'll be hitting the ball 400 yards. So all the golf courses for these top players become redundant, or you're looking at this thing about this the other day, when you get all these big tournaments now, they come in 25 under par. Well, those golf courses were designed for you as the best player to be able to shoot par. And so it's the same issue.
Hanson, hey, listen now, okay? I got something to say about this, all right? You, Warren, and Kevin, and Tyler this morning, all the talk all the time is about the growth of curling in Canada. We need to get it bigger. We need to get more young kids involved. We need to make it interactive. We need to get into the streaming world. We need to have betting and wagering on curling. If you want to get more people involved in curling, why wouldn't you want to make the game easier, Warren, instead of making it tougher?
Because we can't score. That's the issue right now. And in any sport, to crack attention, the only sport in the world I know that gets away with 1-0 and 2-1 scores and still have millions of people interested is soccer. Most sports, the whole function and purpose is scoring. Defense is boring. And that's been a challenge that we've faced with this sport over the last, probably going back into the 80s, was a big issue. Mm-hmm. That's where it all started. And 2-1 games aren't attractive to anyone. Mixed doubles. I designed mixed doubles. It was all, again, designed of how are you going to be able to have lots of scoring go on? How is somebody never going to be out of the game if they're three down? And these are things we got to look at with the sport. If we want to attract people to it, you've got to be able to score.
So when you're talking about accuracy, Warren, then probably a way to look at it rather than make people hit the deck to do a Donnie B and try to stop somehow, maybe have that the release hog line. It's not a hog line, just a release line where you put the magnetic devices under the ice. Yeah, maybe it is 6 feet quicker. It that would definitely cause you to get your alignment a lot sooner. That is something that, and you're not changing.
You back it up.
Just back it up 6 feet, and that would give people a lot less time to get in line. And of course, the shot is further, makes it more difficult. Tyler, this is something that you won't realize yet, but because you're so young. But when I was in early 2000, say 20 years ago. If you made a 15-foot run back, that was a big deal. That was not a common shot where you're just going to make a run back and stick it. Now, if somebody like you or Sterling, say, the two of you guys, if you miss a 15-foot run back, if you don't make contact with the rock in the house, that's a terrible miss. Like, that's a makeable shot now. Back 20 years ago, that was not very makeable. So that's kind of where we're coming from with evolution. The game continues to change because the athletes get better, which is terrific. But I think the no different than golf or hockey with the trapezoid, or you know, name many things, because goalie became a basically another defenseman. So they kind of took that out of their hands, so they couldn't go into the corner and get the puck. Your thoughts on maybe adjusting this hog line a little bit so that it made it a little more difficult for all these at present simple runbacks to become maybe not so simple anymore?
Yeah, I think making the game harder is definitely an interesting concept. The game's obviously changed over the years to make things more difficult. You look at Broomgate not too many years ago, and I don't remember the Scotty's numbers, but I remember at the Briar there were like five or six teams in the 90s for the entire weekend. So I think sweeping is probably a better way to look at it than just diving on your face and trying to stop before the hog line. I think doubles is a good way to look at it. If you're playing in doubles, if you're low to mid 80s in doubles, you have a very good chance of winning. But in regular curling, sometimes you have to play in the low 90s to even have a chance of winning. So if you're making it harder, I think doubles is a good example that sweeping is probably the best way to look at it. Because if you have to stop before the hog line, that obviously makes doubles a whole lot harder too. And I think doubles is already hard enough, in my opinion. So to make it both harder would maybe make it a little too much.
Okay, good stuff. I want the game made easier. Okay, Kevin? All right, I want it easy when I go to play. So, but I'm not, this just in, boys, I'm not a high peak performing curler. You might find that hard to believe. Okay. Warren, we got to ask you about the Purple Heart. It can be a bit confusing. Who gets the Purple Heart? I remember starting to watch curling in the 70s, and the sweaters the guys had about a million crests on them. And they always talked about the Purple Heart. Give us a little quickly, Warren, a little bit of history. Who gets a Purple Heart? Who should? Some people have different opinions about it all.
So before I get into that, we asked a poll question regarding the Purple Heart, based on the fact that we now have the Briar and Scotties this year going to have 18 teams in them. And the Purple Heart, when it was instituted by McDonald back in 1927, said clearly in the heart is a provincial curling champion. So the Purple Heart was given to people who won a province or now territory. And contrary to what many people believe, it doesn't necessarily mean you were a participant in the Briar. It means you won a province or territory. And it's kind of an interesting story. It goes back to the whole history of McDonald Tobacco and the Briar. And as many people think that Briar was an old Scottish term, it isn't. Briar was a pipe tobacco made by McDonald's. And inside that pipe tobacco was a silver plug in the shape of a heart. And inside that heart was a silver plug was a plastic purple heart that was actually used to tap down the tobacco in the plug. And so that's where the silver hearts came from that are now on the trophy, have been there since 1927. And the purple heart that was inside that plug became the shape of the crest and color that was given to the participants, or in this case, in the winners of the provincial championships. Interesting enough, and no one in history I've talked to over years have been able to tell me this, but the hearts were initially red. And somewhere in around 1935, they went from red to purple. But a purple heart was emblematic and has been, still is, of you having won a provincial championship. Another interesting part of history. During the McDonald days, the province of New Brunswick never got purple hearts because the provincial playoffs in New Brunswick were sponsored by Gunung Chocolates. So until 1980, when Labatt became the sponsor, the winners out of New Brunswick got Gunung chocolate crests. Everybody else got purple hearts. And so when Labatt became the title sponsor of the Briar in 1980, they made a deal with Gunung. At that point in time, they started running the provincial championships, which were called the Tankards in Labatt days, and the curlers in New Brunswick started to get purple hearts. So that's the history of it. The Scotties became sponsored by McDonald Tobacco in 1972, was called the McDonald Lassie. And that's where the red hearts came from for the lassies. And as time went on, of course, they left. Scott Paper came in. They kept it going. And hearts were brought into the other championships. I think the first one was the mixed back in about 1980, again, where they started with silver hearts. So it's always been emblematic of winning a provincial title in a particular event. But what's happening here this year, why we're asking this question, is we've now got 18 teams playing in the Scotties and the Brier. 14 of them are provincial territorial champions. One is Team Canada. Three are wildcard. I'm not sure, wildcard one, two, and three, I guess. So you've got 14 teams that are going to get hearts, in the case of the Brier Purple Hearts. One, Team Canada, will get a silver heart, and three teams will get no hearts because they're wildcard teams. So we asked the question, the Purple Heart is a sacred institution, goes back to 1927, emblematic of winning a provincial or territorial title. For the upcoming Scotties and Brier to be played in the bubble, there'll be 18 teams competing, and some will have not won a title to be there. They will be there by appointment. Having said that, who should receive a Purple Heart? Only those who have won a competition to be there, 71% say that. All the participants, 50%, and none of them should get hearts because of this irregular year. And it's kind of interesting, again, I think of the way this whole thing has been evolved, that it probably going forward, because quite between you and me, I don't think 18 teams is going to go away. It's going to continue. And there's lots of reasons for me to say that. I think if you participate in the Brier, you should have a Purple Heart. If you participate in the Scotties, you should have a Purple Heart or a Red Heart. And I think that would make the whole thing equal. But again, as we've seen on the Facebook page, a lot of people from the older part of the spectrum do not agree with that. And another interesting question for discussion.
What Kev was getting a Purple Heart. What is that ever? Can you imagine today if you were going to come up with a new trophy or some sort of qualifier for someone, and you said, okay, we're going to sponsor it from a cigarette company. Could you imagine trying to do that today? Listen, I loved curling when I first saw it in the 70s and everyone was drinking beer and smoking cigarettes on the ice. I said, I could do this. This is fantastic. Was it a big deal, Kev, to get a Purple Heart?
Oh, boy. Back in going back to 1991. So that's prior to all these other events existing. There was no Grand Slam. There was no really big tour events. There were some small isolated like car spiels and stuff around. So when it came to big time curling, there was one thing to really, really strive for. And that was your provincial championship to get that Purple Heart. So it meant absolutely in the sport of curling, it was absolutely it. And then try to get to the national championship, which of course, when I was young, 91, I was only 24 years old. And that would have been a complete, you know, couldn't even imagine such a thing, get to the nationals, win that, go to the worlds. That was a pipe dream. So but it's kind of interesting now, things have kind of changed. Like your top pro, if you want to call them pro curlers, the top high performance players, they're everywhere, all over the globe every week. So I guess it's up to those players what they deem to be the important thing for them. You know, one thing that evolved with me until I retired, the Players' Championship became very, very important to me because it was the best of the best. And if you want to be the best, you got to beat them all. And so that's why I really, really enjoyed. That was my favorite event other than the Olympic Games. That was my favorite event later in my career. But if you're talking about 1991, oh, mm-hmm. my goodness. Yes, mm-hmm. getting that first Purple Heart was absolutely terrific. It was a dream come true. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, it's all about evolution of sport. What do you deem to be important? And what do the public mm-hmm. deem to be important and the sport? And you're right now, you know, that's up to each individual as to where they feel the importance of the sport is.
So Tyler, you're 100 years younger than Hansen and Kevin. What does it mean to you? Is it still something you say we want to get a Purple Heart or we just want to win the province?
Going to the Brier is the main drive, and obviously the Purple Heart's a big bonus and like a kind of a trophy for that. The big goal is always just to go to the Brier, and obviously Purple Heart's tied to that. So kind of goes hand in hand.
Okay, so it's still alive and well. Very good, boys. We had a great show, Tyler. Thanks a lot for coming on. I do want to ask you, Tyler Tardy. I love your handle, by the way, The tardy party.
Yeah.
Huh? Because you're, I'll tell you what, you're slipping under the radar here, Tyler, for a guy who has a handle called the tardy party. Okay. You're pretty low key. I'm saying he's like the president of the chess club, Kev. It's like, okay, they're really serious. Okay. But wait till you get with them. Okay.
Right.
The crazy tardy party. You're passionate about junior curling, Tyler, and you've won three titles. How did you do that? Because I know other juniors who've got the dream, want to know from people who have won it, and you've won the worlds. How did you get there? How did you get to be able to play at such a high level? And how did you win three Canadian juniors?
There's a couple things. I think a big part of that, especially at the junior level, is working towards the best technical excellence you can. I think a big part of that is trying to learn and going to camps. You know, at a very early age, I don't even know if Kevin remembers this, but we were at his camp about 6 or 7 years ago. So we were pretty small guys out there, and we learned a lot of things, and things that we still hold on to, such as the J curve and making changes, going on a bit of a dip to go higher. So a big part of success in juniors is always being willing to learn. I think at the younger age, you can kind of get into a bit of a stubborn patch where you feel like you're good enough for everything. So always knowing that how you can always learn in this sport, even like today, we're still constantly learning, doing as much as we can to get better. And a big way to learn is doing camps and doing WCT events, I think, is huge at a junior level. My first WCT event was when I was 15. And sure, wow. You get smacked all the time, and you're going to learn those games. It's hard, obviously. You know, we play in some events like in Portage, and we can't even get on the board, and we can even tell that we're getting laughed at because our scores are so bad. But we're learning, and you're slowly creeping up, and you can close that gap pretty quick. And if you can close that gap in the juniors, you're gonna be a pretty big force to be reckoned with in the junior ranks.
So if you had to pick, the sense I'm getting, if you had to pick one thing to advise teams who have the dream about first winning a Canadian title as a junior, and then of course a world, would you tell them technique, work on your technique?
Yeah. Technique and playing in events where okay. you're challenged pretty significantly.
Very good. Tyler, you've been fantastic. It's been great to have you on. It's good to have you young guys on to keep these old guys, Kevin and Warren, in line. It's great. Best of luck to you, Tyler, through these challenging times. And we're going to be watching for you and your brother and the rest of your team. It's obviously you've got lots to offer to the game, and you're passionate about it. And congratulations on a great career that you've had so far. And it sounds like everything you've done, it sounds like you're like 60 years old. You're only 22, pal. Okay. So way to go, Kevin. You brought it once again. And Warren, thank you very much, boys. Another great show. You can email us, okay, if you want to get a hold of us. We'd love to hear from you. And you can do that at, insidecurling@gmail.com. Thanks a lot to everyone for listening and tuning in, and we'll be back next week with another show. We want to thank our new sponsor, Manscaped, who brings you the best ever in men's below-the-waist grooming. They're a Shark Tank company, by the way. Okay, two of the guys invested in it. It's available in Canada, and every Canadian male now has the chance of experiencing Manscaped's life-changing product. Go to manscaped.com. That's manscaped.com. And if you use the code INSIDECURLING, you're going to get 20% off and free shipping. So manscaped.com. Thanks a lot. Use the code INSIDECURLING. Boys, another one in the books. Stay safe, and we'll be back again next week. Thanks a lot, Kevin. Thanks a lot, Warren. Thanks a lot, Tyler. And we'll talk to you next week with another episode of Inside Curling.